this country, in 15 or 20 years' time, the black man will have the whip hand over the white man.
Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
I don't call it ratting, I call it an insurrection.
The whites have become black.
If you open your door to uncontrolled immigration from Middle Eastern countries, you are inviting in terrorism.
The British people have voted to leave the European Union, and their will must be respected.
Welcome to About Race with Rennie Edo Lodge. I feel like feminism has consumed most of my adult years. Nowadays, we talk about it in the context of social media, television debates, and even Hollywood. We've got Donald Trump as a catalyst for women's marches. It's not as hard as it once was to make the case for the movement. I was most active in the feminist movement between the years of 2010 and 2015. Some of the campaigns I can remember getting lots of press coverage were Holler Back, a movement against catcalling and street harassment, and No More Page 3, the campaign to remove boobs from the pages of the Sun newspaper. The paper cancelled the page in 2015. There was a campaign to get a woman on a British banknote, and Jane Austen started gracing the tenor in 2017. Then there was a movement to ban lads mags, led by the organisations UK Feminista and Object in 2013. It was the decline in print media that killed off those publications. Now, I don't want to do down the efficacy of any of these initiatives, but the common thread is that they were all led by white women. This was the case for most high-profile feminist activism at the time, and these women were often called on to speak for all women. The thing about feminism is that it is an active movement. Sometimes it's full of heat, sometimes light. When I was involved in feminist activism, it felt quite frenetic. And in my book, I dedicated an entire chapter to the British movement's whitewashing and willfully ignorant defensive denial about racism. In fact, it was the chapter that I wrote first. Quick definition. In my book, I describe intersectionality as a crossover of two distinct discriminations. So for people who are both black and women, that would be both racism and sexism. The word emerged from the work of academic Kimberly Crenshaw, who was using it in a legal context, in a system that recognised racism as separate to sexism. This is important to feminism because we know that structural discrimination doesn't just start and end at sexism, and the movement needs to reflect that. I took a step back from feminist activism due to book-related duties. And now, I really want to know if, since my time in it, the British feminist movement has improved, on race in particular, and on intersectionality more generally.
Okay, Sisters Uncut is a feminist direct action group. We take action against cuts to domestic violence services. We argue that DV services are public services. So we look at housing, immigration policy. And Sisters was founded in 2014. I think a lot of the original Sisters who were in the group were in this other direct action group called UK Uncut, which wasn't explicitly feminist in its orientation. And I think a lot of women and non-binary people felt a bit exhausted by organizing with men. So Sisters were not open to organizing with men. It's a woman and non-binary only organizing space.
Sisters Uncut. You might recognize the name because of their high profile actions. They protested the UK premiere of the film Suffragette back in 2015. And they invaded the red carpet again at the 2018 BAFTAs. I'm speaking to Kelsey and Angelica, who are both sisters. Not in the biological sense, but in the activist sense. That's Angelica you just heard. If you're not familiar with direct action, it's a type of politics that uses public protest, like a demonstration, a strike, or the occupation of a building, to get a message across. It's often complementary to party politics, because it applies a very public pressure to our politicians. I asked them both why the group is better than most at putting intersectionality at the heart of their activism.
I'm wary of making a grand statement and saying that Sisters is like the most intersectional group or that Sisters practices intersectionality perfectly. But I can talk about the ways in which Sisters tries to be intersectional. So we offer to pay your transport to come to the meetings. We try to make sure that there is childcare available at all of our meetings so that anyone with dependents or older sisters can come.
We only have meetings in accessible spaces.
Yep.
So like physically accessible.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So wheelchair accessible. But again, all of these things aren't perfect.
Yeah, because I mean, accessibility means different things.
It's not a one-size-fits-all thing. And sometimes we have made some massive mistakes. Like
we should talk about it.
So we reclaimed or occupied a building last summer. And there was a disabled toilet, but no one thought to get it unlocked. So it was just locked the whole time. And someone had to go home, had to leave
the space.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was a case of everybody knew that that was a problem that was happening on the first day.
But then no one
took it upon themselves to actually deal with it because it didn't apply to them. And they assumed someone else was. So we mess up a lot, but we hold ourselves accountable and we try to learn from it. You know, a big part of organizing in an intersectional way is about centering the people who are facing a lot of marginalization. So particularly trying to elevate the voices of disabled sisters, sisters of color, etc. But sometimes that can cross over into like just tokenization, like sort of the oppression Olympics and the kind of almost crossing over to the point where a person of color can't be challenged, which in itself is dehumanizing. Do you know what I mean? Because it's still, you're only seeing them as a person of color.
Yeah.
Or, you know, oh, we don't want to, kind of a bit of a rant, but like the kind of obsession with looking intersectional as opposed to necessarily being intersectional. So I recently called out the group on sort of something to do with like there being a focus on having a lot of sisters of color in the photo.
Pictures, yeah, this happens so much.
So to the point where someone had stated that we should cancel an action if there aren't 50% sisters of color, visibly sisters of color as well. Like, not everyone who identifies as a person of color necessarily, like, would you be able to see in a photo?
Well, many exactly. Parts is white.
Yeah, and so if there weren't 50% sisters of color in the photos and this action, then we should cancel it altogether. But not once have I seen it stated that we should cancel a meeting or a decision-making process because there aren't 50%. Do you know what I mean? Like, that number came out of nowhere and it's just for the visuals, not necessarily for the organizing, which I found really, really harmful. Yeah.
And so, it's interesting they do it with race and not with, like, disability.
No, exactly.
Or with, like, class.
Exactly.
Or well, migration status.
Those two things. Yeah. Well, those three things are much less visible.
Visible, of course. Yeah, it's very performative and tokenistic.
Exactly. I've definitely been on the receiving end of this kind of behaviour. I recognise it as well-meaning, but I think it still misses the mark. I think it's a byproduct of the extreme fear that many white people have around this conversation. I asked Sisters about this phenomenon of white deference to people of colour in anti-racist circles.
If you think about the way like white activists in the West fetishize, like, not that Martin Luther King and like Nelson Mandela, Malcolm X aren't worth like appreciating because they're great, but then just you see this fetishization of a person of colour from the global South because they are a person of color. I mean, it comes from them not seeing us as fundamentally at our core people as well. They're so scared of being called out and being accused of being racist rather than actually interrogating their racist behavior, which is just so frustrating because then they project all of their like, oh my God, like their fragility onto you.
Fragile white ego and their guilt. Because that's often the reaction as well is like, I feel bad about being white. And it's like, that's not what God. I need
it's
from
so
you.
Can I tell indulgent. You?
That gives me fuck all. Do you know what I mean? Yourself.
Can I tell you about the first event I ever did for the book? Almost a year ago now.
Okay.
A white woman burst into tears in the audience.
No way.
Yeah, she burst into tears.
White woman crying is racist.
Congratulations, you've made it about you.
White woman crying is racist.
Made it about yourself.
It's very racist.
What Angelica and Kelsey are speaking about, the deference, the tears, is a really destructive byproduct of anti-racist conversation, in which white ears hear black voices talk about racism and interpret it as information designed to make them feel like they are a bad person. So my self-expression at the general state of play becomes a very individual and personal attack to whatever white person happens to be within earshot. In circles where people consider themselves to be progressive, like feminism, that destructive individualization doesn't always come out in anger and defensiveness, but folds in on itself in the form of guilt. What this does is take the conversation away from an analysis of structural power and moves it to a place in which we all need to look after that one white person's hurt feelings, give them a tissue and a hug, and tell them that they are not a bad person. Somehow, the conversation ends in the place that anti-racists are trying to drag it away from, which is tiptoeing around white people's feelings. I think that's what Angelica meant when she said, white women crying is racist. Are some of those things that we've discussed issues that you've seen in Sisters in terms of people collapsing in on themselves in guilt, crying?
There's elements of people definitely backing down and being deferential. It's not inherently racist to ask someone to justify their opinion, especially in a non-hierarchical organization. Like, it should be that everyone has a chance to speak and everyone has a chance to like voice their concerns. Mm-hmm. And so, but I think often, like, if it's a person of color that has proposed something, they're much less likely to
be challenged
in any way, which can be a problem.
Yeah, because sometimes we have bad ideas.
But just like everyone else.
Like everyone else.
Yeah, exactly.
It's having the right to be wrong.
Something that I've noticed in Sisters is the tendency to treat people of color as some kind of homogenous group who all think the same way.
Yeah.
Which just is really unhelpful.
Well, and white people get to be individuals, don't they?
Exactly.
Yeah. What I'd like to see is white feminists challenging their own unquestioned assumptions about racism, rather than just blithely nodding along with what I have to say because they're scared of being wrong. So I decided to ask an often challenged white woman about all of this stuff. The feminist writer, journalist, and activist Laurie Penny has been called the voice for this generation. It's a position that bestows her the media mic so frequently on every issue affecting women ever that it's basically untenable, making her the object of many a call-up. She wrote a piece for The New Statesman in 2014 titled Why Patriarchy Fears the Scissors. For women, short hair is a political statement. It drew sharp criticism for universalising her white, middle-class perspective. One critique that I read was from Latina writer Flavia Zodan, who wrote about how curly and textured her hair was and how she'd been advised by white hairstylists to cut it short and straighten it so that it would behave. For women like me, short hair equals docile hair, she wrote. And in 2017, the 6,000-word piece Laurie wrote about Milo Yiannopoulos and his followers split opinion. Yiannopoulos is the former Breitbart writer who insists he is not a part of the alt-right, but has since faced an expose from BuzzFeed that revealed his alleged links with Nazis and white nationalists. Some people accused Laurie of cozying up to him in order to get the story. Others said her work on him was entirely unsympathetic. It's fair to say that Laurie's writing comes under a lot of scrutiny. What have you learnt from being called out?
Good things and bad things. I definitely pay more attention to it now. I think it's made me a better writer. I believe that it has. It's certainly made me a better thinker. And when everybody's yelling at you in that way, it's sort of, you've got two options, which is that you either just completely wall yourself off and you know, shut down, decide that everybody who has ever said anything nasty about you is completely wrong because you're the most amazing person and you're always right. Or you open yourself up and you try to stay in the room.
Mm.
And that's really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also had to develop some more self-confidence and integrity because the thing for me is, you know, legitimate, genuine call-outs will be arriving on the same forums and often at the same time as right-wing harassment
mm-hmm.
and, you know, really disgusting, vicious, nasty stuff. So it's often quite hard to tell what's what.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody will be saying, you're a terrible racist, and somebody will be saying, you are a bitch and you deserve to be raped to death. Those will kind of hit you in the same place because it's going past so fast and it's very easy to get confused and say, oh, well, all of these people are just harassing trolls.
White feminist women in the public eye are frequently called to account about their failures on race. I've definitely been a part of that. There is an expectation that white women talking about equality should get it on all other fronts, and a deep feeling of frustration when they choose not to. I believe that once you've been made aware of it, anti-racism is a choice, and there's nothing more disappointing than when your fave feminist doubles down on her ignorance. But on reflection, I think these conflicts are sometimes asking too much of these women. For me, growing up in London was a very multiracial environment. I didn't realise the sheer extent of the whiteness of Laurie's early life.
Quite a lot of the personal stories I read about people's experiences of race were on LiveJournal and on early blogs, and everyone exaggerates a little bit, right?
You say you read them on LiveJournal. Was that because you weren't hearing them in real life?
Oh,
or
yeah.
Offline?
Most people I knew until I moved to London when I was 20 were white.
Right.
I grew up in Sussex and I went to university in Oxford. I had friends of colour, I just didn't know them I hadn't met them in person.
Mm.
Like, you know, it wasn't a face-to-face thing. So that was where my anti-racist education started, because that's where I made friends who weren't from the area I grew up in.
Mm.
But yeah, I always assumed that people were exaggerating a little bit, because everybody exaggerates a little bit when they're 14 and on the internet. And then I got to the US and I was like, oh no, holy shit, this is all real and so much worse. I mean, it's not that Britain's not a racist country, it's a deeply racist country, but in America, it's so much more in your face.
Well, what were you seeing?
I think it was the first time I'd really been aware of myself as a white person. Not because I hadn't thought about privilege and unpacked that backpack a little bit beforehand and been having those conversations, but you walk around New York and you're aware of your race constantly in a way that I think for white people isn't normal. And yeah, it was the first time I started regularly thinking of myself as a white person. And this is something that impacts me on a daily basis. You know, that whiteness is a really big part of my everyday experience. It's not just a default, invisible thing. And I really started thinking about it a lot more. The political experience of whiteness was different.
I'm interested in why it didn't occur to you in the same way while you were living in Britain.
I've thought about this a lot, and maybe it's just the experience of being outside the culture you're familiar with.
Mm.
Maybe just the everyday experience of whiteness in Britain was so normal to me that, you know, I didn't notice it anymore. Being a white person is probably a little bit different in every country. It just, I don't know.
Laurie has an international readership. She told me about the prejudices she sees in her readers outside of the UK.
I've genuinely had people ask me when they hear I'm from London, it's like, well, is it safe for you to walk around in London? Like, there areas where white girls can't go?
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, people really think this.
You should be, well, I'm here, aren't I?
Yeah, of course, yeah. It's like,
managed to get on the plane.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of really pernicious, racist and particularly Islamophobic narrative pumping around the alt-right about Europe and in particular about the UK. I do a lot of feminist work in Germany, and Islamophobia is something that comes up a lot. And I often have even young women, always young white women, obviously, ask me about, it's often about the hijab, you know, is it okay for women to wear a hijab? You know, how should I feel about this as a white woman other white lady, why don't you tell me how to feel about this? Because it's all about us, obviously.
A lot of well-meaning white women ask me what they should be doing to help the anti-racist cause. But I'm primarily interested in expressing myself rather than teaching white people how to be. So here's some advice from a well-meaning white woman.
I mean, it starts by educating yourself, and it starts by trying to integrate anti-racism into everything you do. I think my first major book was Unspeakable Things, and that book did suffer from not wanting to get things wrong, so not really paying enough attention to race. Out of fear of getting stuff wrong, which is a legitimate fear, you know, people aren't terribly forgiving when you do mess up. It's about being brave enough and taking the risk to do the work anyway, and being brave enough to get things wrong. Trying and getting things wrong and then trying again is better than just sort of opting out. And I think that's where a lot of white feminists are. It's not that they want to ignore race. It's that they think they can get away with not talking about it because it's easier. It's a combination of cowardice and laziness rather than active malice. And yeah, for me personally, it's just been about being braver and taking more risks. And sometimes passing the mic and handing on opportunities that you get. Like if you are asked to write something or to speak in an event, which genuinely a woman of color would be a far more appropriate person to do that kind of work, then hand the mic over. Like this is probably the longest conversation in any sort of official capacity I've had about me and anti-racism.
I asked Sisters Uncut if anything is getting better.
It's a constant struggle.
Constantly. But then I just look at the, for example, like the Me Too movement, right? Which is what people are taking as like the face of the feminist movement in 2018. It's just so white. It's very liberal, very Eurocentric. The BBC pay like these like women on like six-figure salaries arguing about, I mean, obviously everyone should be paid equally as well. But I'm like, come on, man. You're making 400k and you're arguing about making 400k.
And like, we're supposed to be so upset.
I'm like, this is like
can't join
the
their feminist group
of the
then.
Agenda.
Exactly.
Like, this woman was like really ripping into this guy. She was so angry about, I mean, she, rightly so.
It's not hard to sympathise with the concerns of women at the top. If anything, their struggles show us that no amount of money can shield you from sexism. But there's a difference between sympathy and empathy. Our empathy, the driving force behind our feminism, needs to lie with the women at the margins of society.
I have gone on to organise in other groups that aren't sisters, and there have been similar issues, not naming any names, but there was one group. It was a group that was organising around prisons and incarceration. And there was a series of videos that we were working on. And the person doing the videos didn't address race in any of the videos. Mm. And a woman of color called them out. Mm. And they said, oh, yeah, don't worry. Like, I'm planning on looking at race as well as class and like migration as if these were like separate, isolated things and not integral to the way, you know, power and incarceration.
And gender. We're
looking at prisons. Like,
isn't there
how
like
can you look at prisons
stat.
Without talking about race?
There's a horrifying stat about like the vast majority of women in prison have experienced some kind of abuse.
Of course.
Something like 53% have experienced domestic violence.
Yeah.
Where's that from? Seeing as you both reeled it off.
It's it's the latest
Women in prison
stat that they updated because it was the last one was 46%. Mm. And then just a couple months ago, I think a new stat came out. So it's over half.
So it's clearly not a single issue struggle.
Definitely no, exactly. Not.
And there's links between women in prison and being in foster care as well.
This is one example of what it means to think in an intersectional way. It's not about add-ons or guilt or oppression Olympics. It's simply a means to analyse inequality in the world. I'm not going to lie to you and tell you that I know loads of women in prison. I don't. But understanding the societal factors that contribute to them being there definitely informs my feminism and tells me that any work I do against sexual violence has to take these things into account. If anything, once I shifted my feminism, from discussions about Page Three, magazines and banknotes, to discussions about care work, prisons and immigration detention, my understanding of how gender inequality affects women's lives broadened exponentially. I'm not saying that media representation of middle-class white women doesn't matter, but it's truly the thin end of the wedge. We're still a long way from a feminism that works for everyone. This week in Signal Boosting Podcasts, I'm going to shout out Otega Uwagba's In Good Company. She wrote this amazing book called Little Black Book, A Toolkit for Working Women. And she has a podcast series where she speaks to lots of young women entrepreneurs about their business practices and how they got off sort of starting their creative careers. So it's really fascinating, whether in you're a 9-to-5 or doing shift work or you're self-employed. I particularly love her episode with PR professional Sabine Zettler, and her approach to pitching is just fantastic. So definitely check that episode out and the whole podcast, because it's fantastic. About Race with Renny Edo-Lodge is written by me, produced by Renee Richardson. Our researcher is Rez Marino, and our research assistant is Isis Thompson. Original music is by Matt Sidiso, and artwork is by Kevin Morosky. You can join the conversation using the hashtag AboutRaceWithRenny. Full transcripts and episodes are available on our website, aboutracepodcast.com. If you like what you hear, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to the show on your favourite app. This podcast is funded by Arts Council England.